So tonight we're going to get back to a study that we've been taking kind of a break from. And we're going to talk about a series of lessons we've entitled The Priesthood of God, Good and Bad. And the reason we're doing that, one, is this is an oft-neglected study in the Bible. But number two, really, as I hope you've seen, some of the great New Testament lessons for us as Christians can really be seen through these priests, because we are priests. The New Testament refers to Christians as a royal priesthood to God, and there's a very special connection when we look at men who truly served in the Old Testament, even though it was a special priesthood, to serve God as a priest. We can learn from them good and bad. And so just kind of remind you where we were. Remember that with the end of Phinehas, for some unknown reason, the priesthood switched from Aaron's son Eleazar and his family line, which it should have continued on, and for some reason it switched over to the fourth son of Aaron, Ithamar, and now the high priesthood is in his family. This would be equivalent to the royal family over in England if Queen Elizabeth had a brother or sister, and all of a sudden, now it shifts over to that brother or that sister. And so we talked about Eli last time, both good and bad. You might remember that Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, you also notice that there are some common names between the two, Phinehas being one of them. Not the same person, obviously. But they were worthless men. They were terrible priests. And God was upset at Eli because he did not remove them from the priesthood. He did not condemn them when they caused Israel to stumble. And God told Eli that he was going to remove the priesthood from his family. Well, that doesn't happen right away. That doesn't happen at this point. It will happen later on in the book of 1 Kings. So at some point, this is going to swap back because of what God says to Eli. But I want to remind you of a story we looked at in connection with Eli, which I'm going to refer to as the Day of Ichabod. And this is a story where you might remember that Israel had lost a battle to the Philistines, and they determined that God was not with them, and so they figured out, how can we get God with us? And instead of repenting of their sins and humbling themselves before God, they decided to take the Ark of the Covenant, which contained the very mercy seat, the throne of God, into battle with them. And you remember, Eli was not in battle, but his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, escorted the Ark of the Covenant to battle, and they lost. They lost an incredible battle to the Philistines, and so many Israelites died. The Ark was taken, Hophni and Phinehas died, and when Eli heard of the death of his two sons and the loss of the Ark, he fell over and he died. One of the darkest days, if not the darkest day, in Israel's history. And you might recall that Eli had a daughter that was giving birth to a child that same day. And she had heard of all that had happened. And that as she gave birth to the son, she named him Ichabod, which we kind of remember, you know, we think of Ichabod Crane, right? And the legend of Sleepy Hollow. But the word, the name Ichabod means no glory. And that's what she felt was of this day. There was no more glory in Israel. And she gave birth and named him Ichabod, and then she herself died in childbirth. So, I want to remind you of that day of Ichabod, that dark day, because that's going to come up a little bit in our story here. And so with Hophni and Phinehas dead, the priesthood now resorts to Ahitub. And we know Ahitub, a grandson of Eli, becomes high priest, but there's nothing recorded of him. And so we're just going to keep going on. Now his son becomes high priest, Ahijah, and this is the days of Saul. He becomes high priest in the days of Saul. And he really, the one story that is told of Ahijah, we want to take a look at that very quickly. Let's go over to 1 Samuel chapter 14, if you would. And this is really the beginning of the downward spiral of Saul. God has already rejected him, given the kingdom over to David. And now David, or Saul, just continues to spiral downward. And I want you to notice, as Saul is about ready to go into battle with the Philistines, I want you to look at verse 16 following. Chapter 14, beginning verse 16. Now Saul's watchmen in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away. And they went here and there. That multitude that you're reading about there, that's Saul's army. That's the Israelite soldiers. They're melting away. So Saul said to the people who were with him, who had not melted away, number now and see who has gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Saul then said to Ahijah, there's the high priest, bring the ark of God here. For the ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. Now while Saul talked to the priest, the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continued, and it increased. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. And Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to battle. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow. And there was very great confusion. So what's happening here, where this is really the only story of Ahijah? Well, Saul's troops are deserting him. They're going to the side of the Philistines, and Saul's kind of panicking. So he calls the high priest, Ahijah, and he gathers to him. He tells him, go get the ark of God. Now, there's a little debate here, whether he really is talking about the ark of God, because it says the ark was with him in that day. But remember, because of that day of Ichabod, they had lost the ark. And yes, eventually the Philistines found an Israelite house, I believe the man's name was Abimelech, in which it was residing, in which it was safe. But there's nothing that says they took the ark from Abimelech's house, brought it here, and then took it back. Because that's where it is when David goes to bring it to Jerusalem. So most people believe what is really spoken of here is he wants the high priest to bring the ephod. And the ephod was part of this breastplate here, which contained two items of the priest, the high priest, known as the Urim and the Thummim. And they would use these devices to inquire of God. And somehow, God would manipulate those devices, the Urim and the Thummim, and give an answer. And to this day, we're not sure how that all happened, or even what these devices looked like, or how they worked, or how they got God's answer. But they were used to inquire of God, and that's what Saul's doing here. But then as he is talking to Ahijah and inquiring of God, he panics. He hears the Philistines and all the commotion, and he knows his troops are deserting him. And so he says to Ahijah, withdraw your hand. In other words, I'm not going to take the time to find God's answer. I'm not going to inquire of God. I've got to take matters into my own hands. And so he doesn't inquire of God. And I'm sure if God would answer him anyways, for God had rejected him. But you might recall the first time that God became really upset with Saul was a very similar situation where the Philistines were coming to battle. And Saul was waiting for Samuel to offer the sacrifices before they went into battle to have God's favor, but Samuel delayed. And finally Saul lost his patience and said, "I'll do it myself." And offered the sacrifices to God, which was unlawful for him to do. And so what transpires is a series of terrible events, culminating where Saul almost kills his own son, the only redeeming quality of Saul, if you will, almost kills his own son, Jonathan. And that's the story of Ahijah. That's the thing about these high priests. A lot of times there's not a whole lot that is mentioned there. But I think there is a good lesson for us when we look at Ahijah that I know for myself, I lose patience with God. And sometimes my prayer life is not what it could be, is not what it should be, and it is all because I feel I don't have time. I don't have time to really think about what I want to pray for. I don't have time to get into it. I'll do it later, but right now I'm just going to do a quick prayer because I got things to do. And that definitely has affected my prayer life. Maybe you're the same way. But we look at what Saul, if Saul would have gotten the answer from God, if God would have answered him, there might have been a whole lot of difference in what happened in the aftermath of all of that. And I can't help but think, perhaps, maybe I have foregone some of God's blessings, some of God's work, some of God working in my life or through me because, well, like Saul, there just wasn't time. So I thought, we've got to make time to inquire of God, to call upon Him, and not just to ask Him of things, but to give Him great praise and glory and thanksgiving. Well, after Ahijah, we get to Ahimelech. And Ahimelech is the high priest that we want to talk about for the rest of the lesson. Just a couple things that we're going to look at when we talk about Ahimelech. But if I was to have a subtitle for this lesson, not just the good and the bad of these priests, when I look at Ahimelech, it would be this title: Tough Christianity. Tough Christianity. That's what I see when I look at Ahimelech. There are times where being a Christian gets tough. True Christianity is not the easiest thing people have ever done. And I look at Ahimelech and there's some great lessons about the challenge of being a Christian. And that's what I want to talk about. Now there's a little debate about Ahimelech, whether he was the brother of Ahijah. Some believe he was the son of Ahijah. But in the New American Standard text, he's called the son of Ahitub over and over and over. And that's the viewpoint that this timetable takes. That he was not the son of Ahijah, but he was the brother. And that Ahijah had no sons, and so therefore it went just like a royal family to the next oldest son slash brother. But let's talk a little bit about Ahimelech. The story of Ahimelech is in 1 Samuel chapter 21, if you would turn with me there. The very first story we're going to look at, the first of the two stories. And what we find out is that Saul is still king when Ahimelech becomes high priest. And the story that is reflected about his high priesthood takes place at the beginning where David is now just starting to run for his life. Saul wants him dead. And David runs away, and he runs to, of all places, to Ahimelech in the city of Nob. You'll notice chapter 21 and verse 1, it talks about the city of Nob. The tabernacle apparently is now at Nob. It has been moved from Shiloh to Nob. And a lot of people think the reason that was is because of, again, that day of Ichabod. Remember when they went and got the Ark of the Covenant? Where it was in Shiloh. And when they went and got the Ark from Shiloh, all these terrible things happened. The priest dying, the high priest dying, the loss of the battle, the loss. And some assume, this is just a guess, that maybe some of Israel was a little superstitious and thought, maybe we just need to move it away from Shiloh and move it now to a new city, and that city becomes Nob. That might not be the case, but it's interesting knowing of that all those dark events that happen once they obtain the Ark from Shiloh. And so our story takes place in the city of Nob, where apparently the tabernacle is, and David comes to Ahimelech. He comes for help. He needs some food. His men had to leave in a hurry, and he comes to the high priest for some of that help, for some food. But here's the problem. David does not tell Ahimelech that things are not good between him and Saul. He lies to him. And I think that plays a big picture, a big reason why what happens in our second story happens to Ahimelech. But let's look at chapter 21 as we talk about the good of Ahimelech. In verse 1 it says, David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech came trembling. Notice that. He came trembling to meet David. Why was he trembling? Well, look at what it says. And he said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" I think these little facts here, these little details, help us to understand what kind of character Ahimelech was. He desired good for David. He knew David was a military leader for Saul, and that he was should have been with his troops. And when David comes alone, he thinks there's something wrong. Well, there was something wrong. But look at what David says to him in verse 2. "The king has commissioned me with a matter, and he said to me, 'Let no one know anything about the matter on which I am sending you, and with which I have commissioned you. And I have directed the young men to a certain place.'" In other words, everything is fine, everything with me and Saul. In fact, I'm on a special mission from the king. And I had to tell the men to stay away and to hold up and to play. That's why I'm all alone. That little piece of information there that he leaves out is going to be a very big factor in what happens later. But let's look at verse 3. David says, "Now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread, or whatever can be found." And the priest answered David and said, "There is no ordinary bread on hand, and there's only the consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women." And David answered the priest and said to him, "Surely women have been kept from us, as previously when I set out, but the vessels of the young men were holy. Though it was only an ordinary journey, how much more then today will their vessels be holy?" So the priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which was removed before the Lord in order to put the hot bread in its place when it was taken away. And I want to read verse 7. I want you to pay attention to verse 7. "Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day," look at what it said, "detained before the Lord." That's kind of an interesting statement. This man was detained before the Lord at Nob. Now, there's a little mystery as to exactly why he was detained and who was detaining. If God did it directly, we won't get into all of that, but I wanted to call attention to that. And this man's name was Doeg the Edomite. Now notice he is not an Israelite, he's an Edomite. He's from Edom, he's a descendant of Esau. And he's the chief of Saul's shepherd. So he may not quite have a respect for God and God's ways and God's priesthood. But I want you to just keep in mind, as Ahimelech helps David, who is there witnessing all of that? It is Doeg the Edomite. Just remember that. So, what happens? David needs some food. His men need some food. And Ahimelech says, there is no regular food here. All we have is the bread from the tabernacle. This is the bread that was placed, the unleavened bread, on what was called the table of showbread. And every Sabbath, the priests would put new bread and take out the old bread. And this old bread, what we might call day-old bread, this is the bread he gave to David. It was bread that was only to be given to the priest and eaten by the priest. It was not lawful for a layman to eat this bread. But here's Ahimelech, and he gives it to David. And not only that, he gives him the sword of Goliath as a weapon. That, we won't read that part, but as you continue reading, he gives him bread and a weapon and sends David on his way. Well, what does that matter? Well, interestingly, what we learn is that Ahimelech understood a certain teaching, a certain principle in the Bible. He understood compassion versus sacrifice. In other words, he is being compassionate to David, even though he's doing that which is unlawful. In fact, this is a story that Jesus brings up later on. Go over to Matthew, if you would. Matthew 12. Remember in this story, very quickly, on the Sabbath day, Jesus and his disciples are walking through the grain fields. And let me just set this all up. And the Pharisees are watching David and his disciples like a hawk. And he's noticing, Jesus is letting his disciples take and pluck the heads of grain on the field and eat these heads of grain, which the Pharisees deemed as unlawful to do on the Sabbath. You could do it on any other day. The law even talked about it. But they deemed it, since you could do it on every other day, you could not do it on the Sabbath. It was breaking the Sabbath. And interestingly, Jesus doesn't really deal with whether this was breaking the Sabbath or not. He deals with two things. He deals with their inconsistency, and he deals with this principle, compassion over sacrifice. Let's look at verse 2. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to Jesus, "Look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." But he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry, and how he and his companions became hungry, and how he entered the house of God, and that they ate the consecrated bread?" And look at what Jesus, "which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priest alone." Why is Jesus bringing up the story? He's not justifying necessarily what he's doing. He's not dealing with whether they're breaking the Sabbath or not. He's dealing with the fact that the Pharisees are well aware of what David did, but they never had a problem with it. They never condemned David for eating the consecrated bread. They never talked in lessons about how Ahimelech broke the word of God. They understood the compassion that was needed for David, even though the compassion required the unlawfulness of eating the consecrated bread. Why don't you have a problem with David and Ahimelech? And when you don't, why doesn't that compassion extend to me and my disciples? Now look, if you would, he brings out another one in verse 5. "Or have you not read in the law, that on the Sabbath the priest and the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent?" The Sabbath day was not a day of rest for the the priests. They had to continue to offer those daily sacrifices and other things that were required every day. And again, the Pharisees never condemned the priest for doing that. If you will, they extended all sorts of compassion for the priest for working on the Sabbath. They didn't condemn them. And Jesus, in essence, that's inconsistent. Why are you condemning us? And so verse 7, he brings out the second line of argumentation. But if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, you would have not condemned the innocent. This passage, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, it comes from Hosea chapter 6, verse 6. And Jesus actually used it earlier when he called Matthew 9, verse 13. You might remember when he called Matthew as an apostle, as a disciple of his. Matthew threw this big party with a bunch of tax gatherers. And the Pharisees took issue, and the first time Jesus says is at that event, look at verse 13, Matthew 9, verse 13, but go and learn what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. For I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. I want to tell you, Ahimelech, you talk about tough Christianity, there are a lot of Christians that don't grasp this concept of compassion versus sacrifice. That's a tough thing to understand exactly. What does that mean? When do we enact that? Ultimately, there are a lot of Christians that will say, well, look, it's all about compassion. Compassion, compassion. Don't worry about the law. Don't worry about it. It's about compassion with Jesus. That's not right. That's not what Jesus is referring to. That's not proper application of this principle. In fact, the very next day, Ahimelech went right back to only the priest eat that consecrated meat. He didn't start passing that out. He didn't open up a bakery stand and start selling that to other people. He went right back to sacrifice, to obedience. But there are some Christians that, again, for one reason or another, never grant the compassion side because their mind is all on the sacrifice, the obedience to God. And therefore, even in times where that compassion was needed over the obedience to God, it was not granted. Maybe even you have struggled a little bit with exactly how do we apply this in our Christian lives today. It's tough. But Ahimelech understood it. And he carried it out to perfection. Understanding when compassion overrode sacrifice. He really is a great example of Galatians 6 verse 10, in which Paul writes, while you have opportunity, do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. And he understood when it took compassion to do good to David, even though it meant what was unlawful. He helped David in his time of need. Let's talk about our last story with Ahimelech the Bad. Now, most of the time when we talk about the Bad, and we're going to look at a story in the very next chapter, in 1 Samuel chapter 22, if you want to turn back there. Usually when we talk about the bad of these priests, we're talking about, you know, some bad choice that they made. You know, Aaron and the golden calf, Eli and not condemning his sons. Things like that. But the bad with Ahimelech really isn't because he made any bad choice. The bad with Ahimelech is what happens to him. Because he does what is good. Because he does what is right. So, what happens here? Well, what happens is that Saul hears that Ahimelech has helped David, his enemy. And as we looked at before in our story of the life of David, this is where you really see Saul just starting to go crazy in the mind. And he is furious, and he comes to Nob, and he comes to Ahimelech, and he says basically, "What are you doing helping David?" And Ahimelech basically is just completely confused because David has told him everything is good with Saul. And Saul says, not everything is good. David is the enemy. And Ahimelech, as you continue to read chapter 22, is just like, why? David has done nothing but good for you. Why is he your enemy? Why are you upset that I have shown compassion to him? And so what happens is verse 17. This is his reaction. The king said to the guards who were attending him, "Turn around and put the priests of the Lord to death, because their hands also is with David, because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me." Did they really know? They didn't know because David didn't tell him. "But the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands to attack the priest of the Lord." There is some integrity with Saul's guards there. They're not going to do that. That's crazy talk. But remember Doeg, the man who saw all of this happen? Not an Israelite, but from Edom. Look at verse 18. "The king said to Doeg, 'You turn around and attack the priest.' And Doeg the Edomite turned around and attacked the priest. And he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod." You think he's done? Look at verse 19. "And Doeg struck Nob, the city of the priest, with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and infants." But he's not done yet. "He also struck down the oxen and donkeys and sheep, and he struck with the edge of the sword." And I want you to notice verse 20, because it will become important in our next lesson. "But one son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David." Doeg is a madman. He's a crazy man, just like Saul. Saul says, "Kill the priest." Not only does he kill the priests, all the priests except one, but he kills everyone in the city of Nob, even children, the animals, the flocks, the herds. You talk about another day of Ichabod. Another dark day. This is it. And how many stories in the Bible you have some madman going after God's people? You have so many times where the sons of the king, once he's dead, someone rises and kills all of them. And how many times you see something like that and you hear, "But one of them escapes." Here's another one of those, "And one escapes." And that's all God needs to change everything. To take what is crooked and make it straight. He only needs one to escape. I want us to think about that. You know, we have that little saying, I think, Hillary Clinton's book came out with it, "It takes a village." Well, sometimes with God, it only takes one. So don't underestimate what God can do through you. And then think even more so when a bunch of you, bunch of us are together, even more so what God can accomplish. So as we look at the bad is what Doeg does. It's what Saul commands. "Because Ahimelech helped David, he incurred the wrath," not of God, "he incurred the wrath of Saul." And I can't help but think, if David was a little more honest with him, maybe he would have a heads up. I don't know. Maybe the same thing would have happened. Ahimelech was killed for doing what is right. I think about Peter's epistle, 1 Peter, when he tells Christians to suffer for doing what is right, not for doing what is wrong. What's the value in suffering, doing something that's going to cause you to suffer for doing what's wrong? There's no value in that. But when we suffer for doing what is right, that finds favor with God. And so as I look at Ahimelech, I think of a man that paid the ultimate price for obeying God. You talk about the toughest point of faith, of Christianity. Is there anything tougher than a Christian standing there doing the right thing, even though it's going to cost him his life? I can't think of one. I can't think of a situation that calls for and shows stronger faith than that. When I think of Ahimelech, I think of like Stephen, Acts 7, who became the first Christian to die for the cause of Christ. It wasn't even an apostle. It was what we might just call a normal Christian. I think about the apostles who history tells us 11 out of the 12 were martyred for the cause of Christ. I think about John the Baptizer who was killed for standing and pronouncing the truth to sinful people. I think about the souls that John sees in the vision of John in Revelation 6. The souls that have been slain for the cause of Christ now under the altar as John sees it. Crying out to God to make that which is crooked straight. Brothers and sisters, Christ, we may, and I pray that we not ever be in that situation where it's faith versus life. A life and death situation because of our faithfulness to Christ, our belief to Christ. But I want to tell you, even if we don't face a situation like that, we still have to treat our faith as if maybe we're going to face one day something like that. We've got to make our faith strong enough to withstand that. If that's even possible without going through it. I've seen Christians' faith crumble at far less than such a challenge. So when I look at Ahimelech, if I can put it this way, I look at one of the strongest, most faithful Christians who understood one of the toughest principles in the New Testament. Compassion versus sacrifice. I think of a Christian that was faithful and would do the right thing and it cost him his life at the hands of a man who didn't even understand what righteousness was all about. If we can help you strengthen your faith to be a little more like the high priest Ahimelech, to have a faith that's strong enough for even the toughest situations and teachings and doctrines of Christianity, won't you let that be known tonight as together we stand and as we sing.